Stephen Vladek, who's a professor of law and associate dean for scholarship at American University's Washington College of Law. Now, normally, Stephen would be somewhere in the Washington, D.C. area, but this morning we are talking to him live from France. Good morning, Stephen.
Hey, Tony. How are you?
I'm doing very well. What are you doing over in France?
We actually we have a summer program for a bunch of our law students that travels around Europe, basically teaching the students European economic law, European trade and development law, so that if they want to do comparative practice, they've got a little bit of a foothold. So part of that takes us to France, which is where I am today.
What did the students think about what happened yesterday?
Well, you know, it took them a little while to find out about it, but I think, you know, the students were, like I suspect most of your listeners, pretty surprised. I think a lot of folks had not been expecting either, you know, Chief Justice Roberts to be the critical swing vote, or for the case to turn on Congress's power to tax as opposed to Congress's power to commerce, to regulate commerce. And I think, you know, the students' reactions largely mirrored those of most people.
What I thought was interesting, I happen to be watching Fox News, and they have a lot of attorneys on that program, and they kept trying to reiterate that although many of us was trying to make this a political issue in regards to how the courts would handle this, they tried to look at it strictly from the legal angle.
Well, I think that's certainly true for the Chief Justice. I mean, I'm not sure we could say the same about, you know, everyone else on the court. But I think there's no way to understand the Chief's decision yesterday where he said, you know, Congress does have the power to do this, even though I think we all know it's deeply inconsistent with his political views, as anything other than that, as anything other than the Chief putting the court and the law ahead of his own politics. And, you know, for better or for worse, I think it's an admirable thing for a Chief Justice to do, you know, whether or not we agree with him.
So what did you think and what does it mean?
Well, you know, there's a lot going on in the decision. So I think that the key is to separate out the two major holdings. So the first major holding, the one that got all the headlines, is that the individual mandate survives, right? So what that means is starting in 2014, every American is going to either have to purchase some kind of minimum health insurance or pay slightly higher taxes. And I think that's a big deal. And it's part of the centerpiece of the ACA and part of why it was so controversial. But at the same time, that holding leaves intact a lot of the parts of the healthcare bill that most people like. It leaves intact the requirement that insurance companies not turn you away for a pre-existing condition. It leaves intact the requirement that insurance companies allow 20-somethings to stay on their parents' insurance plans, you know, until they find some kind of gainful employment where they can insure themselves. So, you know, I think there's a lot in the first holding that will make people maybe a little bit uncomfortable politically, but actually better off when it comes to their health insurance. But, Tony, I think that the other piece, and I think what a lot of the headlines have missed, is the other part of the holding yesterday had to do not with the individual mandate, but with the healthcare bill's expansion of the federal Medicaid program. And there, I think the court actually handed a pretty big victory to conservatives by saying Congress had overstepped its bounds in forcing states to accept the expansion of Medicaid. The court said instead states should have the option of either expanding their Medicaid programs or of keeping them where they are. Congress can't make that choice for them.
I think many media outlets tripped up on this because this is very complex. Do we still need time to digest what was released yesterday?
No, you know, I think now, I mean, it's 189 pages, so it's not exactly bedtime reading, but I think we've got our heads around the bulk of what happened. And, you know, as you said, it's complex. Part of that is because there really are four different separate legal holdings in the decision, and the four holdings produced four different votes. So, you know, the first holding was, does the ACA survive? And there the vote was 5-4 in favor, right, which is why we're going to have the individual mandate starting in 2014. That was Chief Justice Roberts joined by the four more progressive justices. The second part, which I think was a bit of a sort of present to opponents of the healthcare bill, was that Chief Justice Roberts joined the conservative justices in saying that the bill actually is not a valid exercise of Congress's power to regulate commerce, which had been the central argument against it. That just didn't matter because Roberts said it was a valid tax. and that was also 5-4. You know, the court struck down the Medicaid expansion by a vote of 7-2, which was surprising only insofar as Justices Breyer and Kagan joined the conservatives to say that. And then the last part was the court said, but even though we think Congress can't force states to put more people on Medicaid, we do think Congress should be allowed to bribe states to put more people on Medicaid. And that was also 5-4 with the chief joining the lefties. So, you know, I think it's complicated, but I think, you know, notwithstanding CNN's, I think, very well-publicized trip up right at 10 o'clock yesterday morning, I think we now know exactly what happened.
You're listening to the Tony Connelly Morning Show on More Compelling Talk Radio, 1320 WILS, 1320WILS.com. We're talking with Stephen Vladeck, who's a professor of law and associate dean for scholarship at American University's Washington College of Law. Stephen, the court also ruled on immigration in regards to the Arizona law.
Yeah, so this was on Monday, and I think this was, you know, hopefully not lost in the headlines because it was almost as big a deal. So on Monday, the Supreme Court basically struck down most of Arizona's immigration law on the ground that it is inconsistent with federal immigration policy. You know, again, I think we've seen efforts from both sides to spin the decision as a huge win for them. It's really a big win for the Obama administration. I mean, what the court basically said by a vote of 5-3, with Justice Kagan recused and with Kennedy and Chief Justice Roberts joining the other three lefties, is that Arizona can supplement federal immigration policy. Arizona can help the federal government carry out their immigration policy, but Arizona cannot make immigration policy for itself. And so, for example, the court struck down the provision of the Arizona law that made it a crime to be out of status. The court struck down a provision of Arizona law that required anyone applying for any job to prove their legal status. And I think those are very significant holdings, not just with regard to Arizona, but also because I think they're going to put the brakes on efforts by other border states, especially border states in the South, to impose similar kinds of restrictions on immigration. You know, I think it's not obviously a big win for one constituency or another because I think immigration is so tricky, but it was a huge win for the administration, which had fought very vigorously to defend this the federal law here.
The Supreme Court also ruled on jail terms for minors that commit felonies.
Yeah, you know, this is what happens at the end of June. You get a whole bunch of big decisions at once. And here we had another 5-4 decision with Justice Kennedy this time, as opposed to Chief Justice Roberts joining the lefties and saying that it's unconstitutional in violation of the Eighth Amendment's cruel and unusual punishment prohibition for states to sentence juveniles to life without the possibility of parole, even for violent crimes. Now, there are a couple of limitations here. It's certainly still possible that juveniles could receive life sentences. The key to the decision was the court's conclusion that they have to at least have a chance at parole some point down the line. You know, I think Tony will see in practice whether that has a real impact, whether states are going to, you know, give people like that, give those kinds of offenders meaningful parole hearings, or whether it's just going to be pro forma. Still a very big win again for the more progressive wing of the court.
The court also struck down the law that in regards to lying about military valor.
Yeah, so this was the Stolen Valor Act. So Congress had made it a crime for anyone at any point to misrepresent that they had received a particular medal. So, Tony, if I right now were to say, you know, I am a decorated Medal of Honor winner, under the federal Stolen Valor Act, that actually would have been illegal. I could be punished for it, even though I suspect you don't take me seriously and none of your listeners would either. What the court said in the Alvarez decision yesterday is that Congress cannot prohibit simple lying. The First Amendment actually protects our right to lie, so long as the lie does not produce any harm, so long as no one detrimentally relies on the lie, so long as the lie is not calculated to achieve something like letting me into your apartment or receiving something of pecuniary value. If it is just a lie, that's protected by the First Amendment. It's a bit of an uncomfortable decision, but I think actually the more we think about it, the more it makes sense that we should be allowed to say anything, including things that aren't true, as long as we're not harming people when we say them.
And, Stephen, before we let you go, what's next for the court? I know they have a break, but what will they be taking up when they come back in the fall?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think everyone's going to take a nice little vacation for the next couple of, well, months. You know, when the court comes back in October, Tony, I think we're going to see a very, very big term, perhaps as high profile as this term.
Really?
Yeah, so I mean, the court already has on its agenda a very big affirmative action case out of the University of Texas, the most important case about the constitutionality of racial affirmative action since the Michigan case from about 9 years ago. The court's already has on its docket a case about a constitutional challenge to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and the power of the government to conduct warrantless surveillance on overseas conversations. There's a huge Voting Rights Act case coming out of Shelby County, Alabama, that the court will probably take up next term. And that's, you know, just the tip of the iceberg. It's going to be a very big term, you know, and I think when we look back on it, this is going to be a very, very busy and important period for the Supreme Court, almost no matter who wins the presidential election, you know, next November.
This has been kind of cool, Stephen. Me and my wife and the kids, we've just been following this, talking about it. It's kind of neat to watch these historic events unfold.
Yeah, you know, Tony, I got to say, the constitutional law professor in me is actually really, really pleased to see how much public attention has been focused on the court. I think, you know, I wish we paid this much attention to the court all the time, because even in decisions that are not as high profile as the healthcare case, as the Arizona immigration case, as the, you know, military valor case, the court is deciding things that affect all of our lives, you know, virtually every day. And the more that we pay attention to the court, I think the more we'll understand both why it matters as an institution and why presidential elections really are referendums on who the next justices should be. You know, I think there's a good chance that no matter who wins the next election, we're going to see a couple of retirements between 2012 and 2016. Justices Kennedy and Scalia will be 80 by 2016. Justice Ginsburg is already in her 80s. You know, so the more we come to realize the role the court plays in our lives, I think the more we'll realize that, you know, a big part of who we choose for president is picking who's going to pick the next justice.
All right, Stephen, thanks so much for taking time out of your day. It's a little past, what is it, about 12:23 in France?
Indeed.
All right, enjoy your time there. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tony. Be well.